The Arizona Board of Regents is considering a plan to change how much so-called dreamers pay in tuition. It's not as low as in-state tuition, but it's lower than what they pay now.
I think this proposal does have some traction. In fact, I would be surprised if it does not eventually pass at their June meeting.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the challenges facing transportation in Arizona.
The Phoenix Police Department will be starting a new cultural training program.
How a proposal for debt-free college could impact for-profit institutions.
And advocates for walkable cities try to keep things in perspective.
So the key thing isn't to make your entire city walkable, but to offer the opportunity for a walkable lifestyle within your city.
Plus, a Hall of Fame gets an actual hall, and how risque is too risque on your train.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I am Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound. There's an accident blocking the shoulder at Loop 101. In weather, there's a high pollution advisory for ozone today. Mostly sunny skies will continue. Still looking for a high of 100. That would be 10 degrees warmer than average. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the lower 70s. Sunny and dry over the weekend with highs of 98 tomorrow and 94 on Sunday. Right now, 97 degrees.
The plaintiffs in the racial profiling case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio are arguing they should be able to question the sheriff's attorneys. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports Arpaio's legal counsel have not yet had to testify in the contempt of court proceedings against the sheriff's office.
Under oath in court last month, Sheriff Arpaio had to tell the court how his office wound up violating the court's 2011 order to stop enforcing federal immigration law. The sheriff claimed he delegated compliance to his attorneys. If that's Arpaio's defense, plaintiffs say, they should be able to depose the sheriff's attorneys and get documents relevant to those communications. So far, the sheriff's lawyers have claimed attorney-client privilege. One of them, Tom Liddy, requested to withdraw at the start of the contempt hearing, citing a conflict of interest. His motion has yet to be formally approved by the court. Another attorney, Tim Casey, withdrew late last year for an undisclosed ethical reason. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Board of Regents has its next full meeting on Monday, and tuition rates for in-state and out-of-state students and so-called dreamers will be the major issue up for discussion. Ann Ryman is a senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and focuses on higher education.
An issue the regents have been grappling with for a couple of years now. Dreamers pay out-of-state tuition rates, and that can be, you know, more than twice what in-state students pay. So they've been under pressure to try to find a lower rate. Now, there is a state law in Arizona that basically says that, you know, students in this category cannot get in-state tuition rates. So what the proposal is to have them pay 50% more than the in-state rate, which the in-state rate, say at ASU right now with tuition and fees, is about $10,000.
Can you give us an idea of whether it seems to have momentum, or at least more momentum than it has in the past?
I think it has a lot of momentum because the rate that they are proposing is not the in-state rate. The Dreamers would pay more than, you know, the students in the in-state category. Now, a couple of years ago, then-Regent Dennis DeConcini had a similar proposal, but his proposal was almost identical to what the in-state rate that they would pay, and that really didn't get any traction from the rest of the Regents, and I think it was because of the state law. You know, they feel they cannot give them the in-state rate, and if they did that, they would be face some legal challenges. So I think this proposal does have some traction. In fact, I would be surprised if it does not eventually pass at their June meeting.
The most recent regular legislative session, which ended very quickly, had a lot of cuts to universities in there again. So, Anne, how could that affect going forward what ASU, U of A, and NAU are proposing as far as potential tuition or fee increases going forward?
Well, all three universities admit that in their fee proposals and tuition proposals, they are going to try to make up some of that cut, you know, by charging some additional, you know, again, fees or tuition. Now, they're not, by no means are they passing the entire cost on. For example, at ASU, they're looking for a $320 one-time surcharge that in-state students would pay. Now, again, per student, what the state cuts ended up being was, you know, more than $1,000 per student. So again, that's not making up everything, but it's making up a portion of it.
Are there other surcharges that may be in effect or that the universities may be looking to charge?
There is a trend toward universities adding fees for certain classes and also for certain programs. For example, if you're in the journalism school at ASU, you pay a fee on top of your regular tuition that goes toward, the school. And the thought there is, they need technology and certain technology to help you learn. And so that degree could be more expensive than maybe some others. And so there is a real trend towards, these program fees and also individual class fees. And that's one thing that, consumer groups say you have to be wary of, because it's almost like flying on an airplane nowadays. The rate you pay for your education may be far different than the person sitting next to you, especially when you take into consideration, whether you're eligible for federal grants.
Ann Ryman, senior reporter for the Arizona Republic. Her focus is higher education. Ann, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
The Phoenix Police Department is going to be embarking on a new training program for its officers. Matt Whitaker, the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at ASU, will be leading the training on what he calls cultural competency.
I'll be doing 8 hours of that. Those 8 hours will be taken up with 6 different modules, beginning with understanding culture and building community, moving through defining procedural justice and legitimacy, through setting the stage historically, talking about the historical relationship between law enforcement and communities globally, nationally, and specifically within our state.
So will these modules be dealing with all different kinds of races and ethnicities and types of people that police will be coming into contact with?
Yes, indeed. In fact, there is a module that deals specifically with immigrants and refugees. Oftentimes, folks mistake the two. That module also will look at religion. It will look at where people are coming from. It will look at the Native American, Latino, Asian American, African American community. We're going to be looking at the LGBTQ community and its historical relationship with the police. So that's one of the reasons why I like to use the term cultural competency, because it's far more than about race. Race is one important component, but it's certainly not the only one. If anyone should be up to date and conversant with the most recent information about communities and cultural competency, it should be our first responders, and they have to make the quickest decisions.
How do you think the Phoenix Police Department and its officers do on that kind of cultural competency now?
Well, what I can tell you, having gone through some walkthroughs and some training, is that I think many people would be surprised. The majority of the folks that I've worked with have wanted the training. They were looking forward to it. What they want is fairness, just like the community wants fairness.
This issue is obviously in the forefront of a lot of people's minds right now based on what's going on in Baltimore. We've seen protests in other cities between the police and community members. Is this, in your mind, an effort by the Phoenix Police Department to try to prevent something like that from happening here?
I do. I think that certainly the new chief, Assistant Chief Kurtenbach, and others, I think that they were amenable to something like this anyway, but yes. What has been happening in the news, going back to Trayvon Martin up through Baltimore, certainly has reminded everyone of the urgency. And I think that they feel the urgency now to do it.
Do you think that cultural competency is something that can really be taught in 8 hours? I mean, it seems like people spend their whole lives sort of studying this and trying to figure out how to find a balance in this area. So I'm curious about the amount of time that officers will be getting this kind of training.
Sure, yeah. It's a challenge, but let me tell you, it's a major first step, in part because, and I've said this a lot recently, a lot of the training that they already undergo, I'm tweaking things for them to see how some of what they are taught may be antithetical to building bridges within certain communities, but they don't realize that. And then communities, many of them don't understand how police officers are trained. So we deal with things like eye contact, body language, tone of voice. And those are things, to use a football phrase, that I believe officers who are trained in audibling, if you will, they can adopt those sort of things and become conversant with it pretty quickly. But there is no silver bullet. There is no push-button solution. I believe that Chief Yonner and others see this as a major first step, but not the only step.
Matt Whitaker is founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at ASU and a foundation professor of history. He expects it'll take up to 18 months to train all Phoenix police officers. For another perspective on this program, we turn to Adriana Garcia Maximiliano. She's project coordinator with Phoenix-based Center for Neighborhood Leadership.
I think it's a step in the right direction. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done. Obviously, an eight-hour training for an officer that's out there, you know, 365 days a week, a year almost, it's not enough. And I think the people who I talked to about this training from the police department, you know, they're excited, they want to be engaged, but an eight-hour training is just not going to do it with the amount of things that our officers have to deal with out in the community. And, you know, I think it's taken them a while to get to this place. And now that they're here, they need to take a step further.
So if this is a first step, what in your mind is a good next step?
So I think for the next steps in improving community and police relations, I think our Phoenix Police Department has mistakenly thinks that transparency equals accessibility. They've made themselves a lot more accessible in the past years, but that hasn't equated out to them being transparent to our community. We also want to make sure that their complaint procedures is better, that it's not just easy to complain about an officer, but that the community knows what happens after you put in that complaint. I also think, even taking it further, we've seen in other cities how community advisory boards that have the power to hold their police departments accountable have worked tremendously to fill this gap of mistrust. If we're using, you know, the metric of an effective police department, a department that has good community and police relations, then I think we need to start looking at these models that have community advisory boards that aren't just tokenized, that aren't just, you know, there for show, that we have a community advisory board with the power of subpoena to make sure that police officers are held accountable when there's incidents of use of excessive force or when there's a lot of complaints about them. That I think those are the next steps that we should be looking at as a city.
In your mind, how does the Phoenix Police Department do right now as far as cultural competency?
I think right now they have great advocates within the police department. I believe Assistant Chief Michael Kernbach has been sort of on the ball to make sure that his officers are trained. But like I said, I think that they're very late to the game in some aspects.
In your mind, are there particular areas where the police department in Phoenix is either really good or really lacking as far as dealing with a particular group of people?
I think they have tried to engage our Latino community more in the past years. I think they still lack in every department with all the other minority communities that we have. Like I said, they're taking steps in the right direction. They're just not there yet.
Adriana Garcia Maximiliano is project coordinator for the Center for Neighborhood Leadership in Phoenix. Adriana, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This week, law enforcement from around the world converged on Phoenix for the Social Media, Internet, and Law Enforcement Conference, which is focused on police use of social media for community interaction as well as crime prevention. Jimmy Jenkins is a producer for the show and is in the studio with me. Jimmy, you spoke to a local police officer who attended and presented at the Smile Conference. Are the police following us on Twitter?
Well, they might be if you have a public account. I spoke with Lieutenant Michael Pooley. He's the public information officer with the Tempe Police Department. And I asked him how his job has changed as technology changes.
Back in the day, we would type out a press release and we would put it out. We would get out to the scene, get more information. But the way social media is working now, you have Twitter, you have Facebook, you have Instagram, you have all these different social media platforms where your everyday person has a smartphone. They have access to this information immediately. They are out there and they're reporting it. And a lot of times the media has that information even before I do. So my job is to immediately get that information, the basic bare essential information, to either confirm a situation or to tell them it's not happening.
I imagine you came from a place of being the primary holder of information to now you're probably trying to put out fires, so to speak, and, you know, quell maybe some incorrect information. I assume that these new modes of communication could be a blessing and a curse for someone in your position.
Yeah, it definitely can be. A lot of times we get information that is not what it's being out to be, but a lot of times it's a very accurate. It's completely on key, and it's very fast. It's real time, and people love that about social media. I like that about social media, as long as it's the right information.
Are police officers also able to use social media for their own ends, as in to help with an investigation? And you know, what kinds of tools did you discover that might be available to you?
You know, the good thing about this conference that we've been able to really get is just different ideas. One of the things that we've been doing that I shared in my presentation is, you know, we're making videos with surveillance videos and putting those out on the YouTube channel, putting them out on Twitter, putting them out on Facebook. We want as much exposure on those people that are committing crimes, especially those people that are unidentified. We don't know who they are. We want to capture them. We want to get them in custody. And social media is one of the crime-fighting tactics that we now use.
It's almost like the new wanted poster, right?
I know. Yeah, absolutely. And there's case after case where we'll get tips, where in the past we had to wait to disseminate that to the media, to get out in the newspaper, to get out on the 5 o'clock news. Now we can do it immediately. You, myself, hundreds of thousands of other people that get these messages and alerts on their smartphones can look at that picture. And you know what? They may be the person right next to you standing in line.
Obviously, social media works both ways. So a lot of people put information out there about themselves. Should they be worried that, you know, a police are looking through my Facebook page or my Twitter feed? How do you walk that line between being an active member of the community and try to combat that kind of negative Big Brother stereotype?
Yeah, you know, we aren't looking at people's social media to try to find things out about them, you know. We do use it for criminal investigations. Social media, a lot of people like to put things out there, things they've done. And we're going to look at those things. We're going to look at if we believe that there's a crime being committed. You know, we get multiple tips from people saying, hey, there's a possibility somebody's involved in some type of crime because of this that they put on their social media. Well, that's something that as detectives and as officers, we have to look into, see if there's a crime being committed. If there's not a crime being committed, we're going to discard it. If there is a crime being committed, then we are going to take action.
That was Lieutenant Michael Pooley with the Tempe Police Department.
Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
You're welcome, Steve.
Coming up, have you ever been offended by an ad on public transit?
If the government starts to say, well, we're not going to allow this ad because we think its message is offensive or we don't like the group, more and more people are going to keep demanding that you take down certain ads.
Are ads for one-night stands, the furniture kind, too offensive for light rail riders? That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. Updating you on Valley traffic. We have accidents on I-10 westbound at 24th Street, also I-10 eastbound at the 101. And in the West Valley, there's a traffic break because of oil on the roadway, I-10 westbound at Verado Way. Look for clear skies tonight around the valley with overnight lows around 70. Should be sunny and dry over the weekend with a high of 98 degrees tomorrow, then 94 on Sunday. And it is official, according to the National Weather Service in Phoenix, we have hit 100 degrees officially at Sky Harbor Airport for the first time in 2015. It's 222.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business presenting the Economic Outlook Luncheon on May 6th. Economists will discuss the local and national economy and the 2016 forecast. Registration at econclubphx.org.
The water table is dropping rapidly in parts of southeastern Arizona. Yesterday, we heard how that's causing hardship for some homeowners and a debate over who's responsible. Today, KJZZ's Will Stone explores what the community is trying to do to fix the problem.
When Rod Keeling and his wife planted their first vineyard, they were only the ninth licensed winery in all of Arizona.
Today there's about 100. So there's been an exponential growth of wineries.
Keeling has just restocked his tasting room, a restored bank and trust building in the town of Wilcox. His vineyard is 40 miles from here, near the Chiricahua Mountains.
We've got a seasonal creek that runs in our backyard. We've got probably 60 or 70 live oak trees.
Keeling is also the head of the Arizona Wine Growers Association. He says vintners have come to Cochise County for a variety of reasons. The climate, cheap land, and until recently, the promise of readily available water.
The water table is going down. We've been in a 20-year drought. The recharge has been poor.
Unlike Maricopa County, where groundwater is regulated, Wilcox and other rural parts of the state don't have limits on how much you can pump. Agriculture sustains this economy. It also uses most of the water. As that becomes scarce, Keeling says they'll have to reconsider what can be grown here. Wine grapes, for example, use about a fifth as much water as corn.
How do we slow or stop the overdraft and grow the economy of the agricultural industry? When you think about going to crops that are more efficient and have higher value, wine grapes are kind of at the top of the hill.
Switching to crops that use less water could be one solution in the long term. What to do now is by no means settled.
There wouldn't be new land in addition to what's already there going into production.
That's how farmer Ted Haas proposes slowing down the decline of the aquifer. No new acres of farmland. It might surprise you this is coming from a farmer, but a gold rush mentality has taken hold here, says Ted's brother, Brent.
We're seeing an accelerated decline of the aquifer now because of higher commodity prices. We're seeing some real estate investment trusts, and we're seeing a pretty big influx of California people because of their drought, and they're looking for areas to expand.
Haas says their goal is to preserve the farms already here. He and other residents are gathering signatures and plan to petition the state to step in. But not everyone is on board with this approach, including rancher Matt Klump.
I have the God-given American right to do anything in this country I want to do. Just because I don't farm my ground doesn't mean that I may not want to tomorrow or that my kids may not want to.
The Klumps have been in this valley for more than a century. He says those trying to stop more farming are simply looking out for themselves. After all, their wells won't be subject to any new restrictions. In contrast, Klum's land, now used for grazing, could never be irrigated and would lose value.
If it's such a life and death issue, everybody needs to feel the pain equally. Where I have the problem is when they try to tell me that I don't have the same right to my property as they do.
To be clear, Klump doesn't want any regulations. Economics, he says, will take care of the water. Only those who can afford to drill deeper will reap the benefits. But the Haas brothers say that's short-sighted. Still, Klump isn't the only one against this plan. Remember Rod Keeling? He says halting new acres of farming would shut down the transition to more sustainable crops.
It would damage the Arizona wine industry, and we probably would be stuck pretty much where we are right now.
For months, all these people, the wine growers, farmers, ranchers, and homeowners, have been working on a compromise, legislation that reduces water consumption, helps homeowners, sustains current farming, and lets wine growers expand. That's not off the table yet. But
we know one thing about water law in Arizona. If there's no consensus of the locals, it's not going to happen.
Consensus might not even solve the problem, but it would be a start. After all, more water isn't expected anytime soon. Will Stone, KJZZ News, reporting from Wilcox.
In the world of higher education, today is known as National College Decision Day. And current trends indicate that no matter where you or your son or daughter may end up going, it'll probably be pretty expensive. A couple of Democratic members of Arizona's congressional delegation are pushing for the U.S. to adopt policies to make attending college a debt-free experience. If successful, the effort would lower tuition while increasing financial aid. Representative Ruben Gallego says he was able to pay off his debt.
I have family student loan debt with my wife going to grad school, and that's what we're paying off right now. But ours is manageable. But the reason mine is manageable is because we were heavily subsidized by the university. The university gave me a lot of scholarships. But the reason I got a lot of scholarships is because I came from a very poor family.
Gallego says increasing opportunity for middle-class students and not burdening them with debt will help the nation's competitiveness.
We are no longer in a prime spot in terms of producing the most bachelor's degrees in the world. We are mostly competing against Europe and Asia now, and they're producing a lot more people with bachelor's degrees than we are. The universities overseas, especially in Europe, are now more like how our universities were in the 60s and 70s, where they were nearly free as possible.
Arizona's 7th District Congressman Ruben Gallego. Earlier this week, Corinthian Colleges closed its remaining 28 ground campuses, nearly 2 weeks after the Federal Education Department announced it was fining the for-profit chain $30 million for misrepresentation. Derek Anderson is an assistant professor in Arizona State University's School of Public Affairs. He studies for-profit higher education.
It's sort of the latest chapter in a long saga that begins with what were once tremendously innovative institutions and have through basically an abundance of resources have seemed to abandon their innovative roots and have become increasingly sort of reliant on replicating traditional universities. I think that one thing to always take into consideration here is that there are lots of different types of for-profit institutions, for-profit universities, and it seems to be the case that they're not inherently bad or inherently problematic, but there are clear signs of certain models that are definitely not going to work. And Corinthian, I think, is clearly an example of one model that's just not going to work.
I know you've done some research on the performance of the for-profits versus the more traditional colleges and universities that we think of. What have you noticed and what have you come up with?
For-profit universities account for a far greater proportion of student loan defaults than they represent in students. So specifically, they represent about 13% of students and 46% of student loan defaults. We also see that for-profit universities tend to spend less per student on instruction per year, and that's far less. And so to give you a specific number, traditional private universities spend something like $12,000 per student per year on instruction, and public universities are pretty similar to that with about a little bit over $8,000 per student per year on instruction. But for-profit universities spend something like $2,500 per student per year on instruction. And keep in mind that at the same time, for-profit universities are also bringing in more federal aid in terms of grants and also student loans per student than public or private traditional universities.
There have been some members of Congress, in fact, from Arizona, a couple of Democrats, Ruben Gallego and Raul Grijalva, that have brought up this idea of cutting back the interest rate on loans for folks who go to traditional universities and whatnot. First, I want to know what your general thoughts are on that, and also how could that affect the for-profit industry?
Well, one thing that we know for sure is that this is a classic example of a complex system. And so, and what makes it somewhat tragic is that we know that people behave differently when they're borrowing money. And we know that we have certain industries that seem to behave in predatory fashions. And so, I mean, we see more sort of predatory behaviors in the for-profit sector within the domain of higher education. It seems to be, in some instances, that they take advantage of the fact that these students have access to tremendous amounts of money that they can borrow. And it seems to be the case that students are sort of really struggling to understand the extent to, you know, what that means for them. I think what we're going to see in the future is many more students sort of coming to realize that that the trends in student loan borrowing are unacceptable for them, and that at least in the case of, you know, of being clients to these predatory institutions, I think we're going to see more sort of activist and more more aggressive behaviors from the students in order to kind of rebalance the equilibrium.
Derek Anderson, assistant professor at ASU's School of Public Affairs. He studies for-profit higher education.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic accidents, I-10 westbound at 24th Street and I-10 eastbound at Loop 101. Look for the sunny skies to continue for the rest of the day today. There's also a high pollution advisory in effect for ozone today across the valley. Clear skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the lower 70s. Sunny and dry over the weekend. Highs of 98 tomorrow, 94 on Sunday. We have officially hit triple digits.
Whoopee!
For the first time in the year. Woohoo indeed. It's 100 degrees at KJZZ at 233.
KJZZ is supported by Gardens at Ocotillo Senior Living, the newest Spectrum retirement community in Arizona, offering memory care living options focusing on person-centered care. More at gardensatocotilloseniorliving.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Baltimore police have turned over to Maryland prosecutors the results of their investigation into the death of Freddie Gray. The report is not being made public, but Deputy Police Commissioner Kevin Davis says the findings include the fact that the van that transported Gray to a police station made a previously undisclosed stop along the way.
This new stop was discovered from a privately owned camera.
The Maryland State's Attorney's Office is calling for the people of Baltimore to remain patient and peaceful while it completes its own probe of the case. A 15-year-old boy and a young woman have been rescued from the rubble of collapsed buildings in Nepal's capital 5 days after a powerful earthquake hit that country. The boy, wearing a New York T-shirt, his face covered with dust, was found not to have any serious injuries. He spoke to reporters and said he began crying out for help when he heard the sound of equipment digging nearby through the rubble. NPR's Kurt Sigler is in Kathmandu. He says there's a real sense of unease there.
People are still very wary here about going back to their homes. Some people's homes are still intact, others not, but we've just continued to have aftershocks.
NPR's Kurt Sigler in Kathmandu, where people are also facing shortages of food and clean water. Hillary Rodham Clinton has her first official competition in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. He is independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He says he'll make the economic disparity in the U.S. a major theme of his campaign.
We can't continue having a nation in which we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major nation on earth at the same time as we're seeing a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires.
Sanders describes himself as a democratic socialist. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 195 points at 17,840. The NASDAQ lost 82 points. This is NPR News from Washington.
The most recent Arizona town hall dealt with transportation in the state, everything from roads and highways to public transit to walking and biking. Scott Higginson, executive director of the Interstate 11 Coalition, was one of the participants.
The number one concern, without question, was funding. And the lack of funding, more specifically, whether you're looking at something for transit or bike trails, or to more our concern from the Interstate 11 Coalition, if you're looking for funding for new highway construction.
Reading through the report, it seems like participants recognize that things might be starting to shift a little bit as far as what residents of the state want as far as transportation. There was quite a bit of mention about how public transportation has sort of taken off a little bit, especially in the urban areas, in the Phoenix and Tucson areas. Mm-hmm. So how do you sort of balance the needs of urban folks who maybe want more public transit and rural folks who don't have access to that but still need good transportation options?
Well, I think there's two different questions there, really, in my mind. There's the transportation that's needed to move Arizonans from point A to point B. And as urban areas grow, they're going to see more mass transit, public transit being used for that function. And there was a strong contingent of transit folks involved in the town hall meeting. You had also a strong contingent of rural folks whose highways and streets are falling apart, and they're looking more for maintenance. But you also have a greater concern, I think, being raised now about economic benefits. And transportation is the singularly most important aspect of developing a strong economy. If you can't move goods around your community, your economy is going to struggle.
What do you think has to happen now to get I-11 really moving?
Well, number one, we have pending in Congress legislation to extend the designation beyond Wickenburg. And then we need to start looking at it in a segment-by-segment analysis. Then we need to go down and to look at that level and see, okay, which of these independent segments needs to be built first, and then start working on that. And there is a segment that stands out that needs to be done first. We refer to it as the missing link. It's the piece between Wickenburg south to I-10.
Another topic that often comes up when talking about transportation in Arizona is this idea of public-private partnerships. And I know that it was something that was discussed at the town hall. Uh-huh. From your perspective, where are some additional opportunities maybe for the state to either partner with a private entity to get something built or maintained or whatever, or just to turn it over entirely to a private entity to deal with the entire thing?
Well, turning it over entirely has a major hurdle, revenue. I mean, if you want to turn it over to a private business to go ahead and build, let's say, the missing link, they're going to want some revenue in order to get paid back for their massive investment. Secondly, I think that there are companies out there who are looking for that, but they want to know, as I was saying, what their return on their investment is. And oftentimes it's government guaranteeing a return. The funding mechanism is gas tax, and that's where we need to see some changes made in our state.
So in your mind, should the state raise the gas tax? Should
Absolutely.
It look for something else?
Absolutely. The gas tax needs to be raised in our state. We're one of the few states that hasn't done it. We're well below the national average for a tax on fuel, and that would be a source that could be capitalized immediately.
Scott Higginson is Executive Director of the Interstate 11 Coalition. Scott, thanks.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Another of their participants was Ramon Ganders, Executive Director of the Arizona Transportation Builders Association, which focuses mainly on building roads. He thinks the state needs to step up and support transportation.
For one, if they stop sweeping, we would get another $150 million on average a year back to the roads. And two, if we can find another revenue source, those two combined, you could probably get an average of $300 million or so plus. So, you know, in a nutshell, we would think that as long as the state were to do its portion that it should be doing right now and finding a new revenue source, whether that's something that's already on the books or creating a new one, you could do a lot with roads right now instead of being in the problem that we're in.
What are the impacts that the transportation system and the state in general are facing because of the lack of spending on transportation right now?
Well, the impacts are definitely dealing with deteriorating roads, you know, aging infrastructure. That's one. Two is the longer we push that off to repair, the more it's going to cost down the line. That's two. Three, you're dealing with a safety issue, period. I mean, obviously, people want to get from point A to point B safely. That's not just for, you know, that's for everybody, right? And then, of course, the fourth would be looking at the consumer in terms of, you know, trying to get a product from point A to market. You know, obviously, it's important that we can do that because goods have to come to market. And if it's harder or more expensive or there's more repairs that need to be done to trucks and vans and other things like that, you know, companies will be more likely to find somewhere else to go to do that. And we of course, that would defeat the whole purpose over the overall economic development conversation.
What do you think are the biggest needs right now? If the state has limited transportation funding, where do you think that money needs to be spent or should be spent right now?
Well, I would probably say probably on the maintenance side of things, meaning the roads that haven't been taken care of currently. You know, I think around the state, people are looking at ways to figure out if they're going to build new capacity, they're trying to figure out a way how to pay for those. So it really comes down, probably it's going to be on maintenance because the roads are so bad right now that in order for us to maintain it, you know, Pima County alone, you know, the city of Tucson claims they need $800 million to put their roads from, you know, a fair condition to a good condition. Pima County says they need $300 to $400 million. So that's just bringing a current road from fair to good condition. So that just puts it in perspective for you in terms of the need would be probably on the maintenance aspect.
Ramon Ganders is Executive Director of the Arizona Transportation Builders Association in Tucson. Ramon, thanks.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Public transit can sometimes be an extra sensory experience, especially with some of the ads we see on buses or light rail around the valley. And when you're the owners of My Sister's Closet, your double entendre puns like Wanted, One Night Stand, or Make a Booty Call were not appreciated. Those ads were pulled by Valley Metro. The Phoenix area isn't alone when it comes to public transit ads causing a stir. New York City, London, and San Francisco, among others, have experienced somewhat similar controversies. For some insights, we called Aaron Wren, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's behind the website Urbanophile.
Transit companies like to make money by selling ads, as well they should. And then in the United States, when a government entity like a transit agency starts selling advertisements, they're not allowed to discriminate based on viewpoint. So if they, you know, accept political ads or ads with message content in them, then they have to basically be open to all comers, regardless of what they say. And I think that's appropriate because, again, it is the government. And unlike a private newspaper deciding what it wants to do, the government really needs to be open to all. That's part of our tradition of free speech in this country.
What are some of the pitfalls of that when government decides to take these ads and then there are going to be complaints? I mean, certainly working at a radio station, we get complaints all the time, but then you have to measure it based on, okay, is this, do we really have to reconsider what we did, or is this just one person who's unhappy and expressed an opinion?
I think that's exactly the issue, right? If the government starts to say, well, we're not going to allow this ad because we think its message is offensive or we don't like the group, then more and more people are going to keep coming out of the woodwork and demanding that you take down certain ads. And so the decision as to what to ban or what not to allow in terms of its message is almost inherently a political judgment. And so it becomes a thorny issue and very quickly becomes the slippery slope, which is why I think in our country we've said, look, we want to have this strong protection of free speech.
How much of that just comes down to this idea that they're afraid of lawsuits as opposed to saying, hey, this is good, this will get more attention? People might think, hey, this is hipper, I want to ride this or something like that.
Certainly that happened in London. There was a controversy in London that a company called Protein World ran some ads on the subway system there with the tagline, "Are you beach body ready?" And there was one with a man and one with a woman in a bikini. And the one with the woman attracted a huge outpouring of people who said it was offensive because it was fat-shaming, promoting unhealthy body image, etc. The company said, we're not backing down, and apparently their sales were quite high as a result of the controversy. But because the United Kingdom does not have the free speech protections that we have here, the government actually did force them to take the ad down, and it won't be renewed, apparently. It can generate a lot of controversy and a lot of attention, and that is good for some people. Other businesses want to shy away from controversy. They like to operate more in the shadows, if you will.
Based on someone who lives in a big city and someone who's exposed to ads and transit ads and that sort of thing, is there anyone that you can think of that you actually thought was pretty impactful in an interesting way, or one that you just thought was, I could see why people wouldn't like that one?
Not really. What I find interesting about the New York subway is that most of the ads promoting viewpoints are put on by the city government itself, you know, in the form of various public service announcements and things of that nature. So the people who would most be impacted by restricting viewpoint ads would probably be the government itself.
Aaron Wren is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and is behind the website Urbanophile.
If you want to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame, you go to Cooperstown, New York. If you want to see the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you go to Cleveland. If you've wanted to see the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame, well, you've just been out of luck. But that's changed. Joining me to talk about that is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Mark.
So what's going on?
So the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame is an organization that works to promote and preserve Arizona's cultural history. And the inductees include everyone from Wallace and Ladmo to Linda Ronstadt. So up until now, they've just had a virtual presence along with some in-person events, but now there's a physical space that's being made into a museum and a place to have shows. I spoke with longtime Arizona musician and president of the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame, Hans Olson, about the impact of a space to call their own.
The general feeling is that there is no entertainment history here. People forgot about it, and we have a lot. Somebody came up with a great slogan for us that says, inspiring the future by remembering the past. Because, like, we started, you know, with Wayne Newton, who is pretty much off the radar of modern acts, unless you go to Las Vegas. But the fact that Wayne Newton, as a kid, you know, was on TV, inspired all the local young musicians, were saying, well, you can't get anywhere from Arizona. But then they watched Wayne Newton. Dark a shame, darling, dark a shame. To me, one of the greatest things people don't know is that Waylon Jennings was based here and got his start. Let's go to Lookin' Rock, Texas, with
Waylon and Willie and the boys. So, Hans, I think you mentioned there's a story about Waylon Jennings getting inducted into the Hall of Fame and his wife, Jessie Coulter, feeling very strongly about it.
Yes, when we had just first started putting this project together, somehow Waylon heard about it, and he said to Jessie, I couldn't care less about being in the Country Music Hall of Fame, but I really, really want to be in the Arizona Music Hall of Fame. So Jessie remembered that, and then after Waylon passed away, she says he came to her in a vision and said, you have to find those people, and you have to tell them that you'll do whatever it takes to help make this thing happen.
I always think that now, more than ever, is a time when people can access music and music history and information from anywhere, from any time. Do you think the presence of a physical hall makes a difference in how people will connect with this music?
I do, because when you see things like Buck Owens' guitar, for some reason, seeing a picture of it on the internet is not like saying, I'm standing here looking right at Buck Owens' guitar, and it seems to do things for people. And all I gotta do is act
naturally. And so now you are in the space that is a bar called Prankster's 2 in Scottsdale, right?
It's very interesting. They built a little music room to the side, more like overflow for when they had big sports events. And one of the partners was a big music fan, so he built a really cool little club there. Prankster's 2 decided they were going to expand that little room and make it four times that size. Let me design it. So, you know, I said, as a musician, I'm going to design it so the stage is very functional, and it's going to be the kind of place where a band comes in and says, wow, I want to play here. Their thought was, you know, once the big guys get involved and there's real money, they're not going to want to be in a strip center. They're going to want to build a palace. And I agree that when it gets to that point where they can see the vision and realize that more money could make it better or bigger, with the kind of assets that some of our inductees have. Like, we have Steven Spielberg inducted, and Wayne Newton and Alice Cooper and Stevie Nicks and Linda Ronstadt. And you put that, if they looked at it and said, wait a minute, this is our Hall of Fame. We want to make it really great. But right now it's just a 400-seat honky-tonk.
400-seat honky-tonk ain't bad.
No, it ain't bad.
For someone who might not know much about Arizona music history, is there one thing that you'd really want them to sort of take away?
Just that there's something about Arizona that so many people are not from here, which I'm not. You know, people think I'm a native, but I didn't move here till 69. And the attitude even back then was that there was no history. Being a part of the scene, I've learned, and I go, are you kidding me? Dwayne Eddy did all his big hits in Arizona. To me, that gave the state more credibility. And I think that's the whole point, is us educating people to the fact that we have as much cultural history as anywhere.
Hans Olson is the president of the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame, and they'll be having a fundraising concert at their new hall in Scottsdale later this month.
KJZZ, Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's the show with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, several accidents to watch out for this afternoon. 51 northbound at Thunderbird, a collision blocks the right lane. Also 51 southbound at McDowell, I-10 westbound at 24th Street. Also a collision I-17 southbound at Indian School. Expect a dry, hot weekend around the valley with a high of 98 tomorrow, 94 degrees on Sunday. We hit 100 degrees officially for the first time in the valley this year. 35 minutes ago, hip hip hooray.
For a long time, Phoenix has been considered an epicenter of the car culture. Some neighborhoods don't even have sidewalks. But that's starting to change, and urban planner Jeff Speck says that's a good thing. He's in town to speak about the benefits of making Phoenix a walkable city.
This is a city, like many American cities, like many younger American cities, that has grown up around the automobile. And so you're challenged by an urban form that kind of presupposes automobile as prosthetic device. And the idea that living with a car is so easy here and relatively cheap here, it's hard to create conditions that incentivize people to have a different lifestyle than that.
Well then, so how do you sort of, for lack of a better word, retrofit the city to make it less dependent on the automobile, especially in an area that's so spread out like Phoenix is?
So the key thing isn't to make your entire city walkable, but to offer the opportunity for a walkable lifestyle within your city. That means having walkable areas within the city that can be quite discreet and quite small. A lot of neighborhoods that are famous for walking are very small. So the good news is that you don't need these vast areas of land to accomplish this. But the second thing is to connect those areas with transit and or biking. Because people, even in walkable areas, people will only walk so far, particularly in your climate. And so the challenge is, if you're going to offer people the choice of not owning the vehicle, then those places need to have proper linkages between them. And ideally, that's transit. Finally, in terms of retrofit, what you're already planning, or at least the more intelligent folks in the city are already planning to do, which is to expand around future transit stops, is absolutely the proper way to key into this sort of quality of life opportunity.
You reference climate, and I have to ask you about that because in the summer here, it's not that pleasant to be outside, much less exerting yourself outside, walking almost any distance. Are there ways to sort of get around that?
I think there's no doubt that it makes walks shorter. It makes biking trips shorter. At least you don't have heat plus hills, which is kind of a killer combination. And, you know, the breeze that you get, if you've experienced it, I have, the breeze you get biking in a very dry, very hot climate actually allows you to go some distance before you hit that sweat threshold. But I think that probably the one thing that is least considered in this discussion is trees. And the need to plant shade trees, and I should say not palms, along your key corridors where people are going to be walking.
Is there a certain reputation, maybe a perception, that a city like Phoenix has to overcome in order to make itself walkable?
No, I don't think so. You already see it happening. You know, I came to Phoenix 2 years ago, and I was not very high on Phoenix. And then I went to dinner with the 25 people in this community who are leading the fight for making the city more walkable and more bikeable. And just to see the energy and the actually successes and determination around that table made me very, very optimistic about Phoenix. But I think this will remain for as long as gasoline or other sources of energy are available at a reasonable cost. This will remain a principally driving city. The question you have to ask, if you want to attract and retain talent, is can you simply provide that walkable lifestyle for those folks who want it?
What's a reasonable time frame for a city like Phoenix to start making some of these changes and really noticing some of the effects from them?
Well, it depends on the type of change. If you're talking about a major investment in transit, then that could be a 5, 10, 15-year project, but it's a very important one, and you know, it's never been done any other way. The sort of changes that I like to implement when I work in cities, because I like to say as a planner, you know, we do 20-year plans, and I've been doing 20-year plans now for 20 years, and I'm tired of it. I try to look for that 3 to 5 year window.
Jeff Speck is an urban planner based in Boston. He's in Phoenix for a summit on the benefits of making Phoenix walkable.
You've no doubt heard the cliche about not wanting to see the sausage being made. Well, KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes us to a decades-old place unlike any other in Arizona.
On the corner of 7th Street and Whitten Avenue in Phoenix is a small red and white shop. It's Shriner's Fine Sausages. Did you know Shriner's Sausages has been a one-of-a-kind store in Arizona since the 1950s?
Yeah, pretty unique. I don't know that you'll find one place that has this kind of variety.
Nancy Schiller is the owner of the place.
We probably make 60 maybe kinds. First would be the real traditional, like your fresh bratwurst, your sweet Italian, hot Italian, Polish sausage, some of the lunch meats like your salamis. And then over the years, it's just evolved from actually customer demand and different type of products.
The store is the size of a large family room. Red and white checkered curtains decorate the quaint shop. The two meat cases filled with different kinds of sausages and lunch meats are the counters.
This is the original building. We haven't ever changed any of it.
Schreiner's Fine Sausages store in the original adjacent food processing building opened in 1955. The original owner, Hugo Schreiner, came from a long line of sausage makers. And when he and his wife arrived here from New York, he decided to open the business. Schiller says her late husband was a native to this Longview West neighborhood and began working at the shop when he was 13. After college, he purchased the business from the ailing Mr. Schreiner, as he still remembered today.
I married into the business. I started working here when I was in college and kind of put myself through school working here. And I knew my husband because I lived in the neighborhood also, and that's how I got the job and married him and never left either. Pretty much this is where we make it all. And this
as we walk into the processing plant, Schiller shows me how the sausage is made and smoked.
Those are our ring bologna down there. Those just got out of the house. It's probably about a four-hour process.
Smells smoky good.
It's a natural hickory smoke. So
in the last several years, the food processing plant had to be expanded. About 85% of the business is wholesale to restaurants throughout the valley and state. In 1 year, about 500,000 pounds of meat is made into sausages. But selling to the public is what has made this place special.
There's a lot of history here. We hope it just continues on and on. We have customers coming in for, 30 years, and that's just a wonderful feel.
Oh, if you ever travel through Glendale, California, look out for a similar shop. A Schreiner's also opened there in the 1950s by a cousin of the original owner here. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
And there's a lot going on this weekend around the valley. First, a shout out to my parents celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary today.
Happy anniversary, Mr. and Mrs. Goldstein.
Should be a good night, Mark. And they're going to be skipping Greg Allman, though, I guess, tomorrow night at 8. But you can go see him at Talking Stick Resort. Of course, Greg Allman, past of the Allman Brothers Band.
Also, Cinco de Mayo Phoenix Festival takes place tomorrow and Sunday. That's in downtown Phoenix.
And also, Bye Bye Birdie, the musical playing tonight at Kyrene Apprende Middle School in Chandler.
The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
I'm Steve Goldstein for Mark Brody. Thanks very much for listening. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. We hope you have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.